Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And our text number is 51551. You can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. I'll bring you one more about Michael Healy Ray. Miriam, your wonderful interview with Michael Healy Ray brought back wonderful memories of my summers in Kilgarvan in the 60s. The stories were just a real blast from the past, and that's from Porrick in Limerick. I'm now joined by Frank MacDonald, who's been writing about planning and corruption and the built world around us since his early days in the Irish press, and then during his long and distinguished career with the Irish Times. His memoir has just been published, called Truly Frank, a Dublin memoir, and Frank joins me now in studio. Thanks so much for coming in, Frank.
Good morning, Mary.
Read that. It's a very interesting read. Let's go right back for people to the beginning, where you grew up and your family. Tell me about that.
Well, I grew up in a very traditional Catholic home in Dublin, just off Blackhorse Avenue, on the north side. So, you know, I can take any of those north sider jokes and turn them around. It was a very religious house, which nearly everywhere was, nearly every home in Ireland was at that stage in the 1950s and even in the 60s. And, you know, I always remember the first flag that we ever flew in from a makeshift flagpole in our back garden was not the Irish flag, it was the papal flag. And we didn't think there was anything strange about that. You know, we thought, well, home rule is Rome rule, so that's just it. And we were all as devout as a Catholic as our parents were. And we used to say the family rosary every evening, kneeling on the living room floor. And on above the fireplace, there was a papal scroll, you know, to my parents and the family from Pope Pius the 12th. And we had holy water fonts in the front, in the hall and also at the back door. And we had a Child of Prague in the breakfast room with the red light in front of us that never went off. And so that, and it was also, don't forget, it was also an era where you know, it was an era of thrift, you know, of make do and mend, of waste not, want not. And my mother was a great baker. I mean, she had worked in Brown Thomas before she got married. They got married in 1948 in Corpus Christi Church on Griffith Avenue. And she had to give up her job in Brown Thomas then to become a full-time housewife, because that was the rule at the time. Women couldn't, married women could not continue on. You know, it was shocking, really, when you think of it. And so, you know, she, every day she'd put on her apron and she'd start baking. So she was baking brown soda bread, buns and cakes and cupcakes. Gorgeous. And at Christmas time, the kitchen would turn into a kind of an industrial zone, you know, where there'd be just like the most enormous production of plum puddings and Christmas cakes. And these were for presents. They weren't all for us. Don't get the wrong idea. They were presents that we would give to the relatives, and we'd travel around from house to house, usually out from Rathfarnham to see my granddad and other relatives. You know, who, and some of them would want iced cakes, and others were quite prepared to just have a fruit cake or whatever. And it was just, and we used to love getting the lick, you know, which was of the bowl, yeah, from the bowl of yummy, the of the uncooked mix, you know, with all those sultanas and currants and raisins and everything else in them. It was just, it was fantastic, really.
Your granddad, is this right, F.X. Coughlin?
Yes.
He was a member of the Rising. What was involved his role?
Yeah. He was, I mean, you know, he never talked about it when he was alive, of course. He was, and in a way that was typical of all of them. They none of them ever boasted about what they did. I mean, we vaguely knew that he was involved in the 1916 Rising in the Church Street area, but we had no idea what he had done, and he just didn't ever say it. Not even on the anniversary of the Rising, the 50th anniversary in 1966. You'd thought imagine. He might have used that as an opportunity to talk to us about what he had done. But anyway, he was under the command of Ned Daly in the Four Courts garrison, and he was involved in building barricades in Church Street and other places, and sniping at British Lancers and all the rest of it. And this all, came out only when the Bureau of Military History published their archives. I think it was 3 years ago. And it was just amazing to read this 5-page typewritten statement signed by my granddad, you know, saying that he, what he had done during the Rising. And, you know, at the end of that week of Easter week in 1916, you know, he has this kind of... He records the fact that they were summoned to go to the forecourts. They were addressed by Ned Daly. They were told that a decision had been made to surrender to the British forces. And as he said, some of the men started throwing away their guns. Others were breaking them up. And the feeling of the beaten team came over us, you know. And, you know, he was then incarcerated in Stafford Jail afterwards. And then there was an outbreak of measles there, which was fortunate for him because he ended up being released early. Then he was on the run as captain of the Rathfarnham Company of the IRA during the War of Independence. And in 1922, after the Doyle had accepted the treaty, he addressed his company and he said... And all of the company, the IRA commanders from the Dublin area, in fact, it was a convention. And he said, the army acts on behalf of the Doyle. And the Doyle has accepted the treaty, therefore we must accept the treaty. And mercifully, he managed to bring most of his company with him on that. Mm. So he was, he then, when the Civil War did break out, when they took over the forecourts, what I called the irregulars, the Republicans took over the forecourts, and my granddad... was in command of, he had joined the National Army under Collins at that stage, and he was in command of the Free State troops to the west of the forecourts waiting for the artillery barrage to finish. And, you know, I'm glad that he wasn't involved in the bombardment and that he had nothing to do with one of the worst things that happened at that time, which was the destruction of Ireland's national archives going back to the 13th century.
And we'll come back to all your work in Dublin. It's a really honest memoir. At one stage, you write, sometimes I think my parents despaired of me. I made my mum cry more than once, which is an awful thing to admit. She saw me as a difficult, stubborn teenager. And I thought it was probably her fault that I was gay, that she had made me that way. This was nonsense, of course.
Well, I think that that is true, that, you know, I mean, even as young as 10, you know, I was having crushes on other boys in my class in St. Vincent's in Glasnevin. And that was something that I had no control over. I mean, you know that debate about whether homosexuality is, you know, nature driven or nurture driven. Mm. There's no question about it. I mean, I was. As I discovered, as in Robert Frost's poem later on in the Fisborough Library, I was going to take the road less travelled, and I didn't really like that one bit at the time, because don't forget there were no role models for us then, unless you count Hilton Edwards and Micheál MacLiamore. Perhaps we would be vaguely aware of them as Ireland's most famous gay couple, I suppose. But, you know, it was really a difficult time in my life, and I thought it was going to be a really lonely journey. And it was something that, you know, I thought of as kind of like my dark secret in a way at the time, something that could never be admitted to my family or friends. And regularly at school, I would have to listen to, you know, boys telling jokes about queers, you know, and feigning laughter and you know, without letting on that I was one of them, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of a, it was awful, really. Mm. And, you know, there were, and I never spoke to my parents about it. I mean, I began to imagine my brain as a series of compartments, if you like, you know, rooms off a central corridor. And I'd kind of park the homo thing in one of those rooms and open it up every so often. But, I mean, otherwise pretend that it didn't exist at all. Mm. And I never spoke to my parents. And now that they're both gone, I mean, my dad died in January at the age of 101, wow, which was an amazing age to reach, you know. And I know he was in failing physical and even mental health at the time, and my mother had died in 2009, having had a stroke 10 years earlier. And he, as I said at her funeral, you know, the last thing my dad ever expected in life was that he was going to be in his 80s, as he was then, late 80s, that he was going to become what's known in the trade as a principal carer. Mm. But when they were both gone, you know, I just thought, you know, I'm sorry I didn't, in a way, talk to them about it. But
do you think they knew?
Oh, of course they did. Yeah. And you know, but I, in a way, I didn't want to burden them with it. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, know, yeah.
And you know, I mean, when I was in my 30s, I remember hearing that, you know, some relative had inquired about whether I had, whether I was getting married or what, you know, like I was getting on a bit, as, whatever, at that stage. And my mother said to this relative, Frank is a gay bachelor with the emphasis on gay. And, you know, when later on when I met Eamon, you know, in 1976, you know, quite by accident outside, this is my life partner, Eamon Slater, outside the College of Surgeons in Stephen's Green. And I was introduced to him by this other, a mutual friend of ours, you know, like, I mean, that was completely fortuitous. And it was kind of like something that shows that, you know, nearly everything that has happened in my life has happened to me by accident rather than design. I mean, I never set out to be this, that or the other in a way when I went to college. But in any case, I mean, my mother used to ring up Eamon every so often and talk to him about recipes,
right.
You know. And we had an adorable Cairn Terrier in the house we used to live in Harold's Cross. And, you know, she would, when they would call over, she would always take the dog out for a walk. The dog was mad about her. And, you know, because we used to, they used to look after Duncan when we were on holidays. And so Duncan always associated her with long walks in the Phoenix Park, you know, which was our playground when we were kids and all. So, you know, it was really, it was something that was there that that they knew about, that but that was never publicly acknowledged in a sense, which was kind of weird, but still.
And interesting, you know, Frankie Byrne, you mentioned in the book, that in all her years as an agony aunt on radio, I think from 63, you're right, 1963 to 1985, you don't believe she ever read out a letter, say, from a guy saying he was having problems with his boyfriend. It was all strictly heterosexual.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah. You know, and actually, one of the reasons why I mentioned that was because, you know, I like to think that if, you know, Frankie Byrne had ever read out a letter from some guy saying he was having trouble with his boyfriend, that I would then have used that as an opportunity. If I was at home with my mother, for example, to talk to her about it then, but it never arose because it was, as you say, it was all just about girls and fellas and never boys and boys.
Was there a moment you can remember, Frank, when you acknowledged to yourself, I am going to accept that I am gay, maybe not tell everyone and certainly not speak to your parents. But was there that moment when you thought, I'm not going to fight it anymore, this is who I am?
There was, yeah. But again, you know, it was in the context of inhabiting a kind of a nether world, you know, which was not a public one. And, you know, I suppose with this book, you know, what I've, you know, I've had this, I suppose, some kind of a public persona over the years as environment editor of the Irish Times and as the author of The Destruction of Dublin and other books. And, you know, I've managed to separate, you know, those two things. You know, like loads and loads of people knew that I was gay, of course, including all of my siblings and others and loads of friends and work colleagues and all the rest of it. But, you know, I never made a point about it. And I suppose in a way, it was, I mean, it was a difficult thing to come out and admit, because don't forget that the legal context was so negative. You had the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act, which made homosexual acts illegal. And, you know, so there was a fear of blackmail. And people sometimes, you know, people in that I would meet, other guys that I would meet, they wouldn't even give you their real names. You know, they would use pseudonyms and so on, because they'd be nervous of being blackmailed or worse. And let's not forget that in 1982, there was this horrific murder in Fairview Park, where Declan Flynn was beaten to death by a group of teenage thugs, and they all got suspended sentences after that. So, I mean, in a way, I only began to feel okay about it all when Maura Geoghegan Quinn introduced her really, and I really admire her for that. I must say, it was one of the best things she ever did, and I think she knows that too. And it was so liberating, really, to have her standing up in the Doyle as Minister for Justice and saying, "We're repealing the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act," and so then after that, I just didn't care. who knew? I just didn't care. I just thought, well, at least we're in the clear now, Miriam. That's
absolutely
what I thought.
Absolutely. And actually, somebody just said, Miriam, it's lovely listening to Frank. Such sadness and joy in his story, the story of so many gay people in Ireland, which is probably true, actually.
Yeah, well, I think that that was part of the reason why I was motivated to do the book, because, you know, it was on foot of a chat I had with John Murray on his radio programme just after retiring from the Irish Times. And I just, you know, Michael McLaughlin from Penguin Ireland rang me and he says, would you consider doing a memoir? And I hadn't even thought of doing that, no more than I ever even thought of doing the destruction of Dublin way back then, until I got a letter from Fergal Tobin from Gillan Macmillan saying, would you ever write a book about Dublin? And I said, well, OK, I will then. So it was a challenge, because Michael said to me, he says, you try and make it as frank and in a way confessional as possible. And that
it is, actually.
And that was that was quite difficult. I mean, some of that book was difficult to write, because I had to kind of get myself into a mindset where I was prepared to acknowledge things that happened, things that I did at the time, and what went on and so on. And, you know, I mean, some people may think that some of it is a bit sordid. I've tried not to be salacious in any way.
No,
in this
it's just
book.
Honest.
And it's just, I'm just honestly describing a netherworld that existed for so long in Ireland. And
I know there are details you don't want to go in this morning,
which
I get, but they're in the book and they're very, very, very honest. Dermot Lacey texted to say, congrats to Frank in his latest book, but more importantly, in his dedicated good work for Dublin and Ireland. I was really pleased when he agreed to accept a Lord Mayor's award from him back in 2003. Mind you, a few people were not so pleased at me giving it to him. I mean, was it really when you moved to the Irish Times in January 79 that your big interest came, Frank, in everything to do with Dublin building planning?
Well, I think what drove me to it was that when I was a sub editor in the Irish Press in the early to mid 70s, and you know we'd be on graveyard shifts sometimes, you know, like until 1 o'clock in the morning or even 4 o'clock in the morning, and you'd be cycling home as I did every night, and I would just notice that the city that I knew so well was gradually being whittled away. There were derelict sites all over the place, and I reckon that there was a story behind every hoarding. And so I started looking into it all and writing about it. And I did this series for the Irish Times in 1979 called Dublin, What Went Wrong, you know. And it caused a bit of a sensation at the time. And that's, in a way, what led to, ultimately, the book being written, The Destruction of Dublin.
Was it Bob Geldof? What was it he said about you once?
Well, he said, it's quoted on the back of the book, he said that I was a permanent thorn in the fat arse of municipal pretension. And, I mean, in his typically pithy way. But it was something that I was committed to, because I think that, you know, here was a city that I knew that we had, that, you know, whenever we had relatives coming up to Dublin, I was always deputed to take them around. And so I got to know places like the castle and the two cathedrals and, you know, all the rest of it. And we used to love, you know, taking them into St. Michael's Church or St. Michin's, everyone calls it, in Church Street, and shaking hands with the Crusader in the vaults in the basement and all that. So, you know, I just thought that this was a story that needed to be written about how the city that I grew up in was gradually being destroyed. And it was being done by roads engineers, most of them from, it has to be said, from the west of Ireland, the wilds of Kerry or Mayo or wherever, who came up to Dublin and who simply regarded the historic city as an inconvenience to the movement of traffic. And I found this whole attitude totally vandalistic and opposed it with every fibre of my being at the time. And, you know, the book came out in 1985. We followed that up with I became an activist, basically. I was not just a journalist. I was not, you know, in the business of saying, on the one hand, there's people saying this, and on the other hand, there's people saying that, and basically we're too stupid to make up our minds about who's telling the truth. So I managed to indulge in something that a lot of journalists can't do anymore, which is original research. I mean, nothing beats original research. documents, finding things, you know, in the planning department, the roads department, you know, the company's office or wherever. So I became a kind of a squirrel in these places, you know, searching for the truth, in essence. And that's what I did.
And achieved great things. It's a great memoir, actually. Finally, you did get married yourself and Eamon in the Botanic Gardens.
Yeah. Well,
great day.
Well, it was fantastic, really. And I mean, it was something, as I said at the ceremony in the registrar's office in Upper Grand Canal Street, we both acknowledged that this was only happening because of the generosity of our fellow citizens in this country, that we're still the first and only country in the world to have adopted marriage equality or same-sex marriage on by popular vote. And that is something that I will forever thank the people of Ireland for. And by the way, can I just say how moved I was last night to see Michael D being re-elected.
Well, look, Frank, thank you so much. Your memoir, Truly Frank, it is incredibly Truly Frank, a Dublin memoir by Frank MacDonald. Thank you so much for writing and for coming in to be my guest this morning, Frank. I wish you the very best. And it's from Penguin Ireland. We'll take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.